From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama go all out in the swing states. Free speech, faith, and red line talk at the UN. Uproar over NFL refs. Mitt Romney, down in the polls after last week's 47% tape, told much-needed Ohio voters that he's on their side.
I care about the people of America, and the difference between me and President Obama is I know what to do, and I will do what it takes to get this economy going.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu brought out the big red marker at the UN, said a line must be drawn on Iran's nuclear development.
I believe that faced with a clear red line, Iran will back down.
And regular NFL refs are back on the job after lockout and uproar over some spectacularly bad calls by replacement refs. Fans were delighted.
Oh my gosh, thank the Lord. Everybody talks about Monday night, but every single game in the NFL has been messed up by that.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Tough talk on the campaign trail, Netanyahu's red line, NFL refs, Foxconn riot. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, Laura Meckler, White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She's been on the trail with President Obama yesterday. Laura Meckler, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Laura.
Let's listen to just a little more of the Israeli prime minister there, the war line in the sand, the red line in the sand. Here he was at the UN yesterday talking about Iranian aggression, urging the UN to step up and stop Iran's nuclear development.
Given this record of Iranian aggression without nuclear weapons, just imagine Iranian aggression with nuclear weapons. Imagine their long-range missiles tipped with nuclear warheads, their terror networks armed with atomic bombs. Who among you would feel safe in the Middle East? Who'd be safe in Europe? Who'd be safe in America? Who'd be safe anywhere?
And the Israeli prime minister pulled out that big graphic drawing of a bomb step by step and drew the famous red line, talked about when and what.
The relevant question is not when Iran will get the bomb. The relevant question is, at what stage can we no longer stop Iran from getting the bomb?
David Sanger, that illustration and the photo of it, people are going to think about for a long time. But in your reporting on this, you say, well, despite the red line and the tough talk, there's a softening going on here. What do you see?
Well, there are a few things going on. First, this is the red line that he didn't want to have to draw. This was the red line that Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted President Obama to draw. In other words, he wanted President Obama to come out before the American presidential election and say that if Iran got to a specific quantity, just about a bomb's worth, of medium-enriched uranium, which we'll get back to in a moment, which is the stuff that we're worried about here right now, that he would join in some kind of attack, that there would be a military threat against Iran for that moment. And the president pushed back and said, look, I'm not going to commit myself to war based on a specific date or a specific amount of uranium. In fact, you could argue that if the Iranians got enough for just one weapon, the last thing they'd want to go do is use that one weapon, because at that moment they've got nothing left and they're facing against two nuclear powers, the United States and Israel.
This is when Netanyahu said the U.S. had no moral right to hold Israel back from taking action.
That's right. That's right. So
pretty tense exchange.
It was a very tense exchange, and it led to a pretty heated conversation that they had that night over the phone that went on for more than an hour.
This is what, 2 weeks ago, roughly?
This was 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, of course, Netanyahu, part of the argument then was that President Obama wasn't seeing Prime Minister Netanyahu or any other leader during his trip to the UN this past week. But more importantly in this is that by announcing yesterday that he believes that Iran would get to this point sometime in the spring or summer of next year, which seems about right if you just do the math from international inspectors' reports. What Mr. Netanyahu seemed to be doing was taking off the table an attack before the election, the big October surprise that we've talked about before on your show and everybody's been so concerned about. So at one moment, he kind of stepped back. In another, he made this somewhat explicit threat that may lock Israel into an attack next spring or summer, but may not. You know, over at Harvard, Graham Allison, who's probably one of the best scholars on nuclear issues, has done a fabulous graphic of the seven previous Israeli red lines for Iran, all of which the Iranians have cruised right by since the mid-1990s. So this red line might be real, but it may not be real. That's, I think, a big issue that the prime minister is going to have to be confronting.
Boy, the graphic was certainly attention-getting. This has all been...
Well, it was attention-getting because it was almost a comic book version of a bomb. You know, it had this little fuse coming out.
Cartoon bomb in the red line.
Yeah, it looked a little bit like the Wile E. Coyote cartoons.
Of course, this all comes right into American politics. The president, even before the UN meetings this week, was pushing back on Mitt Romney's pushing for a tougher posture here. Here he was, President Obama. This was on 60 Minutes with CBS's Steve Croft on Sunday.
Well, let's see what I've done since I came into office. I said I'd end the war in Iraq. I did. I said that we'd go after al-Qaeda. They've been decimated in the Fatah. That we'd go after bin Laden. He's gone. So I've executed on my foreign policy, and it's one that the American people largely agree with. So, you know, if Governor Romney is suggesting that we should start another war, he should say so.
Laura Meckler, you're covering the White House, but it's that last line that got picked up everywhere this week. If Governor Romney is suggesting we should start another war, he should say so. Is anybody saying that, Laura?
Well, no, nobody is saying that. And he's actually, President Obama has said that before about Governor Romney. You know, that's sort of where Mitt Romney is in a bit of a box. He's been very, very critical of President Obama, but it's never been clear, and his messages on Iran have been very mixed, and it's never really been clear exactly what he would do differently.
Jack, so where does it feel like we stand at this point? The president's saying this week, let's be steady, let's be careful here at the UN, but also talking tough on Iran. The Israeli prime minister with that cartoon but serious warning at the same time. Where are we on this, Jack?
Well, I think the Times today, David, frames it right, that there's been a shift in the political situation here, and that seems to have affected Mr. Netanyahu, his rhetoric. He said, I very much appreciate the president's position, as does everyone in my country, a different, very different tone from just 2 weeks ago. And it's as if he's concluded, Mr. Netanyahu, that Mr. Obama looks like he's going to have another term, and he's got to live with President Obama. And what looked like an intervention in our campaign 2 weeks ago, now it's more of a hands-off, although in an extraordinary gesture, I can't remember anything like this, Mr. Netanyahu is talking by phone both to President Obama and Mr. Romney today.
Well, Mitt Romney going in that same CBS News evening, I guess it was on Monday with CBS. He went after President Obama for having talked about the problems in the Middle East as a bump in the road. Let's listen to that.
This is a far from a bump in the road. This is a development in the Middle East which shows that events are spinning to a certain degree out of the kind of influence we'd like to have. We're seeing ourselves at the mercy of events rather than shaping events, and we need an administration that is up to shaping events in the Middle East and not seeing them as bumps in a road.
Laura Meckler, seeing the U.S. is looking at the mercy of events, and we had the White House this week again going with a kind of revisionist line on what happened in Benghazi, where in the midst of all the turmoil about the video and everything else, they're saying now it was a terrorist attack that led to the death of the U.S. ambassador and three others there. This quite at odds with some of the first high official statements coming out of the White House after that attack here. Is the White House in trouble in its depiction of what went on there? Is there a credibility problem here, Laura?
You know, they're in a little, they are in some difficult waters right now with that. There have been questions from both sides of the aisle raised about exactly what happened, exactly what the administration's posture is on that. Was it a terrorist attack? What do senior U.S. officials believe? And I think the messages coming out have been very, very confusing. So I do think this is something that they're going to have to sort out. I don't know if it's clear yet. I do think it plays into the Romney critique of Obama for sure. I don't know yet whether it's rising to the point of something that voters are paying a lot of attention to yet.
Jack, what do you think? I mean, you were looking at this right away after that attack, and reports coming out that this was militants who were nearby the White House saying, oh, this is about a video, this is about protest, but now saying very clearly right up to Leon Panetta and more, this was a terrorist attack.
Yes, I mean, I think you can cut them some slack. They didn't know the fog of war. But when, as others have pointed out, it was really Susan Rice's appearance on 2 weeks ago on Meet the Press where she really was basically saying, oh, this was another demonstration. And that was lagging. That was even behind what the Libyans were saying. That was mm-hmm. bad stuff. And John McCain made clear in a statement the other day, intimated at least, that Ambassador Rice would have a hard time being confirmed for Secretary of State in a second Obama administration just on the basis of that performance. And that performance has geared up the Wall Street Journal editorial page to revive their culture wars of the 90s against Hillary Clinton, saying, ah, they're all covering up for Hillary Clinton. So we're back to that.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news battle in the swing states, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Red lines and free speech at the United Nations, NFL refs back to work, and a lot of uproar around that in this country. Plenty more. Foxconn Europeans will look at it all with David Sanger of the New York Times, Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, and our own Jack Beatty. Jack, you mentioned John McCain. Yeah, he was really wailing on the White House about this characterization of what happened in Benghazi at the U.S. consulate in Libya. Here he was on Thursday talking with CBS This Morning.
I think that this was an orchestrated attack. Clearly, the organization that was heavily involved is involved with extremist organizations. And so I can't say exactly, but it's clear that there is a connection between these people. And to say that it was a spontaneous demonstration is really beyond belief.
David Sanger, this can easily look like the White House, for political reasons, in the early days after this attack, or hours even, trying to tamp down the notion of a terrorist attack because it came on 9/11. It would look bad. It would go against the narrative of President Obama as tough on national security and effective.
Well, it certainly does go against that narrative, but I think we're sort of looking at the wrong end of the question. Mm-hmm. The question that we're looking at is what they've said after the event. And as you indicated before, there is a good deal of fog that goes around after any terror attack. I think the big question, as it was the big question before 9/11, before most other attacks, is what did we know prior to this attack and what should we have known prior to this attack? So there's the issue of why the ambassador was so lightly protected. Part of the answer appears to be that was his preference, that having viewed himself quite rightly as somebody who played a big role in saving Benghazi a year and a half ago, he believed he had many friends there and did not want to have a big protective corps that separated him out from the people. Mm. But when something like this happens, that suddenly doesn't look so good. The second question is, were there intelligence warnings that something could happen? And were those warnings in such a form that they could be put together and communicated back to the embassy in Libya in time? And that's going to take a much more complex investigation. But there is one really disturbing sign. If you see in our paper yesterday and today, the FBI group that has operated to do the investigation into what happened in Benghazi.
That we heard right away was being sent in to get on top of this, to figure it out.
That's right, to figure it out. They're not in Benghazi. They're in Tripoli, 400 miles away. Why? Because there's no way to assure their safety in Benghazi. So nobody wants to send the FBI agents in until you've got the proper protection for them. The question is, did anybody make a similar judgment about the ambassador and the other staff and the two locations that the United States government had in Benghazi that were both attacked.
Laura Meckler, does the White House have concern? You're covering there. Do they have concern that this has legs, that this may push back against the president's, you know, assiduous cultivation of his foreign policy, national security efficacy here, that he's got trouble on this front? And the bump in the road comment about the Middle East that Mitt Romney came back so hard on.
Yeah, I think that, it's, you know, whenever there's uncertainty and instability, it's always a cause of concern on a political campaign. I don't think those political advisors think that this has yet broken through to the point where it's a real threat to him. And, you know, as you noted in your introduction, you know, right now things are going pretty well for him on the campaign. You know, he's up in polls all over the battleground states, and other things are dominating the campaign narrative. And further, you know, Romney is focused his campaign on the economy. So it's for him to really, you know, hit this hard is a little bit off message for him, although he has, of course, mentioned it from time to time. So I don't think we're at a tipping point yet, but I think that potential is there. And I think that the White House and the Obama campaign are aware of that.
We'll look at those latest polls. Let's get a couple calls, if I may. First, New York, North Collins, New York. Kelly's calling. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In listening, I really appreciate your show. And what concerns me is that our president has not backing Israel. It's just so obviously that he's not backing Israel. And it was so disappointing at the convention when it was brought, Israel was brought up, you know, and the vote, the big vote about Israel and about bringing God in, and it was such a sham. It was so obvious that the people didn't want it, and yet they passed it, and it was like very embarrassing. But he can't be trusted. He totally cannot be trusted to back Israel. And once he's a lame duck, Israel is in big trouble, because he seems to be backing the Muslim nations much more, even in ridiculous ways, you know, than he is backing Israel.
And you're saying that, Kelly, in spite of him standing at the UN this week and saying, you know, this far and no farther, we will be there, they won't have a nuclear weapon, that doesn't persuade you?
Had to say that, and he said it out of pressure. He didn't want to say it.
What about when he says, and we played the tape, if Governor Romney is suggesting we should start another war, he should say so. What about that?
Oh, Romney doesn't want another war, but Romney is strongly believing in and doing what we are responsible to do in the Middle East, and he's trying to get Obama to stand up and to be a man and to be an American.
Well, responsible to do. I guess there's many interpretations of exactly what that means. But Kelly, let me hold that if I may and get one more. Masood is calling. Hi, Masood. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First time caller, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to respond and make a comment on what Netanyahu said. He's been saying the same thing for the last 15 years, that Iran is going to become an atomic country and it's going to attack us and everybody else is in danger. So these are all propaganda, basically. They have their own internal problem. They're trying to make a distraction into their own country. And, you know, the world right now is an interesting time right now that we are in. You know, a lot of problems happening, and Iran would be crazy to use, if they're going to get an atomic bomb, to attack any country. That's going to be like suicide for them.
But Masood, they do have a nuclear program. It has, by all accounts, made a lot of progress. What's that about?
Well, it is about independence. It is about in the future, if anyone wants to have their own independence, they have to have that kind of energy in their hand to not being selling their soul to other countries. Because Iran, during the Shah, you know, we had no independence. So what happened? They want to have to have a government so they would have independence to direct the country in the system that would not depend on other countries.
Masood, we've got it. Let me pick it up right there, if I may. David Sanger, you know, there is an argument out there that says it's going to be hard to stop. And Masood says they'd be crazy to use it now or ever. And so let's look at this differently. What about that argument, David?
Well, there certainly is an argument to say that it would be hard to stop Iran from getting a weapon, and that's the core of Prime Minister Netanyahu's argument, that you would have to stop them before they get the weapon. What I think is the big question that is very hard to debate in the heat of a presidential campaign is, What do you offer Iran to allow them to enable them to be able to do what Massoud suggests here and have their independent energy program without worrying about a weapon? And the answer to that is that you come up with a system in which they can do some enrichment at a very low level, well below bomb grade, but have incredibly intrusive inspections, regular inspections anywhere in the country that would enable the rest of the world to be convinced that this really is a civilian program and not a weapons program.
But David, if I may, I think Massoud's suggesting something bigger in terms of independence, not just an independent energy program, but independence, the kind that they may envy in North Korea or Pakistan, who, you know, don't get messed with because they've got – or Israel because they've got the bomb.
I was about to get to that. Mm. So there's energy independence, which is what the Iranians say they want. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, what Massoud is suggesting is that what they want is their own weapon. So what's the difference between North Korea and Pakistan and Iran? Well, in Pakistan's case, they never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, so they're not in violation of their own treaty obligations. In North Korea's case, they renounced the treaty, which Iran could do but has chosen not to do. So Iran has signed up to a global treaty that would bar it from having a weapon. And the question is, can you live with an Iran that is just a few screwdriver turns away from a weapon? And you heard President Obama on that issue this week as well, and you've heard Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I think the Netanyahu position is we can't live with them even having a capability. And President Obama has said we can't live with them having a bomb, and he's never answered the question about capability. But as a signatory to the NPT, if they think they can't live with that, then they need to stand up and say we're going to leave the treaty. Now, they're not likely to do that because I think they know what the result would be from Israel pretty quickly thereafter, and probably other nations as well.
You think we're still on a path, or are we on a path to armed conflict here next year? We've had people say that on our air this week.
I think that if both sides stayed on the exact path that they are on right now, which is the Iranians continuing to produce and not really getting into a serious negotiation about what to do with this medium-enriched uranium that Mr. Netanyahu was discussing yesterday, and if the United States stays on the path right now that it's on right now, where there really isn't a significant offer on the table to the Iranians about how they could keep some element of their program, but nothing that could turn into a weapon, then I think the chances of conflict next year are pretty high. That, however, could well be turned over if after the election you began to see some movement on both sides. It would be nice to think that would be possible. I'm not sure necessarily at this point it is possible because both the Obama administration and the Israelis and, of course, the Iranians are pretty well dug in. This is a 15, 20-year-old dispute.
Yeah, let's go to Brentwood, Tennessee, and Kay. Kay, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I in response to the caller that said that Israel's got to, you know, kind of like take its place in the world. It, you know, it's allies, but it can't be boxing us into a corner for another war. And Mr. Romney, you know, you just can't be boxed into a corner for another war by one of our allies. We have to stand, and Mr. Obama's just standing and watching. And I think right now, as long as he's paying attention, I think he's doing a great job.
Kay, I appreciate your call. Very happy to have it. I want to turn to Romney and Obama and those polls this week in the swing states and more. This was a Saturday campaign rally in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and President Obama went right at that 47% comment on the tapes that came out of the Romney fundraiser. Here's the president.
We can't move forward if we've got leaders who write off half the nation, calling them a bunch of victims who'll never take responsibility for their lives. I don't see a lot of victims here today. I see hard work in Wisconsinites.
And the president rolling that message out around the country in swing states this week. In Ohio on Wednesday, Mitt Romney was asked by ABC News' David Muir about recent polls that show him falling behind President Obama in Ohio and other battleground states.
I'm curious what you would say to some of your supporters tonight, your donors, who might be concerned that this could be slipping away.
Well, I'm very pleased with some polls, less so with other polls. But frankly, at this early stage, polls go up, polls go down.
Polls go up, polls go down, early stage. Laura Meckler, what about the polls this week? What do they show when it comes to those all-important swing states?
Yeah, for those of us, including, I would say, Romney, who have lived through this long campaign, it doesn't necessarily feel like an early stage right now.
It's almost October.
Right. What the polls show is that nationally, President Obama is up a few points, but which is not that significant. But more importantly, I think, is in the battleground states, the, you know, half dozen or eight states around the country where the race is really being fought. And in several of those, definitely the majority of them, Obama has a healthy lead. In some cases, a large lead. There have been polls in Ohio, which is a critical battleground, which has shown him up as much as 10 points. So, his margin of victory in 2008, which was obviously a much more friendly climate for him, was nowhere near 10 points. So this is, he definitely seems to have the advantage right now. And this 47% comment is one that the Obama campaign is playing hard. It's up with a new ad yesterday that's running all over, which is, I think, a very effective ad. It just basically plays the audio of his remarks in the background and then shows sort of images, still images of Americans who are the so-called victims. And it's I think it's a pretty effective ad. So and I'm sure next week the first presidential debate is on Wednesday. I have no doubt that this will be a topic of discussion there.
Jack, how are you reading the polls this week? I mean, some of them had the president 10 points up in Ohio. That sounds big, and we're almost in October here, but it can feel close, and there's some rough economic numbers out there. What do you think?
Well, I think the predicate for the explosive reaction to this 47% remark, and it has been explosive, 90% of people in Colorado knew about it. I mean, for example, whereas Etch-a-Sketch, a week later, only 45% of people knew about it. It's really got attention. But the explosive reaction to it, I think the predicate was really put down by the Obama campaign at the beginning of the summer when they ran those anti-Bain ads. And they basically said Mitt Romney is a heartless plutocrat who has thrown people out of work. And when challenged by Bill Clinton, by Cory Booker, by high-minded people saying, oh, we can't criticize finance capital, that's how capitalism works, the president said, this is what the campaign is about. Mr. Romney's business experience does not qualify him to be president. On the contrary, it should be seen as a debit, given the kind of experience it was. So that was the contention. And then along comes, in Mr. Romney's own words, someone sounding like a heartless plutocrat. It's devastating. I mean, I just think it's as if the Obama campaign had wanted to order up anything, this, you know, that would really hurt Mr. Romney, perhaps irreparably. It would be something like this, because they put down the premises, and they held to that campaign. People were calling it demagogic and so on. They stayed right on that, and it hurt.
Comes something that looks like proof of the pudding. But David Sanger, there's that lousy growth in the second quarter, and Mitt Romney out on the campaign trail pointing at that and saying, come on, people, do you want more of that?
Well, there is. Let me just finish up on the ad for a second. Let me just turn to the growth issue. I was out in a swing state yesterday, and this new Obama ad is remarkable because, apart from hearing Barack Obama get on and do that ritual, you know, I approve this message, there is no other voice in that advertisement other than playing the tape. They're just trying to make sure that the tape is played.
And the tape,
on the numbers, I was somewhat astounded that we did not hear Governor Romney hit that even harder. I mean, that's the message he's got to get back to, which is whatever recovery was happening, you know, the numbers seem to be slipping away. And I'm sure the Obama camp is hoping that this campaign ends as quickly as it can.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a big riot at Foxconn's Taiyuan manufacturing facility in northern China, where iPhones and more are made, shut down production for a day. 2,000 workers took out their frustration. And it was Emmy time. Awards night host Jimmy Kimmel went after his parents in the audience for telling him he could do anything he set his mind to.
So this year, I set my mind to winning the Emmy. And guess what, Mom and Dad? I didn't win an Emmy. You told me I could, and now I didn't, and I'm devastated because you lied to me.
And velvet-voiced singer Andy Williams, crooner of Moon River, died on Tuesday after a battle with bladder cancer. He was 84.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday.
Andy Williams, we're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. Does President Obama have an answer on the economy, jobs? Who should answer for those terrible 1.3% growth numbers in the second quarter, revised now? And are you watching the big austerity protests in Europe? Is that coming here? Was your iPhone made by those rioting Chinese workers at Foxconn? Have you been wondering? And were you cheering the NFL refs back last night singing Moon River? For Andy Williams, dreaming of rivers on Mars, sign of that, NASA tells us. Mitt Romney trying to talk a lot about his care for the American people this week. In fact, doing it in a number of settings. Here he was on NBC News talking to in Toledo, Ohio on Thursday.
I care very deeply about the American people and people of different socioeconomic circumstances. We've talked about my record in Massachusetts. Don't forget, I got everybody in my state insured. 100% of the kids in our state have health insurance. I don't think there's anything that shows more empathy and care about the people of this country than that kind of record.
Mitt Romney on Tuesday. Now, Laura Meckler, that's true, but it seems like kind of like a funny line for Mitt Romney to be taking at this point in the campaign after complaining so much about the national health care reform that was largely modeled on that Massachusetts plan of his.
It really is amazing. I mean, it's sort of, how is it that he gets credit for compassion for the people of Massachusetts, but Barack Obama doesn't get credit for the compassion for the sort of the people of the nation doing pretty much the exact same thing? I mean, Romney has gone to great lengths to explain how he thinks it's different when you do it on the state level versus the federal level. But I do think it is kind of an amazing statement to make. And then, just that very same day that he said what you just played, he was on the stump, you know, going after so-called Obamacare with, you know, just an incredible amount of, you know, viciousness. So it is, I think, a mixed message coming from him then. You know, had he chosen to run a different campaign, he might not have won the Republican nomination, but he could have, you know, run on that achievement as the only, you know, the first person in America, the first leader in America to really tackle the problem of the uninsured. But that hasn't been the approach he's taken for most of the campaign.
You know, we heard that angry tape from workers in China at a plant where iPhones and more are made. But there were some very big demonstrations in the streets in Europe this week, in Greece, where it is tough times with austerity, in Madrid. Just listen here. Thousands of protesters to here in Spain protesting austerity measures. David Sanger on the economy. You know, China's got its troubles now. Europe certainly has its troubles. The stock market has been way up here. But globally, the president's still looking at a pretty tough picture, looking into a second term, if that's what it is.
Well, that's true, because the question is, where does the growth come from? And you'll remember that when the financial crisis really first struck in 2008 and 2009, people said, well, fortunately, Europe's still growing a bit, and China will be the great driver. And in 2009, you saw President Obama meeting with Hu Jintao on several occasions, the president of China, and talking to him about what many came to call the creation of a G2, an alliance between the world's largest and second largest economies. Mm. That didn't work out terribly well. The Chinese took it as a sign of weakness on Obama's part. But the big concern now is that if the Chinese can't keep the kind of growth and the kind of demand going that we've seen, it's not clear what the big driver in the world economy is going to be. And the Europeans, as you could tell from that soundbite, are going to be wrapped up in this austerity debate for many, many years to come, because they clearly cannot allow the kind of benefits, social benefits, to continue that have wreaked this kind of havoc in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland, and other places. So the next president, whoever it is, may be talking a lot in this campaign about growth here at home, but their biggest problem may be where the growth for American exports is going to come from.
Jack Beatty, what are you thinking as we see these images of Greeks getting dinner out of dumpsters? All those Europeans in the streets in southern Europe, in Spain, in Greece this week. I mean, there were big debts there. Now there's big austerity, and you see the woe coming out of it. I don't know. Are there parallels here? Are there morals here? What are you thinking, Jack?
Well, what I'm struck with is just how counterproductive this austerity clearly is. Austerity, people get laid off in order to meet the demands of Germany, basically, and the bond market. People are laid off. That depresses economic activity. The government then has less money to pay to pay off its debts, and the cycle just keeps going around.
But if you were German, would you want to keep underwriting those debts? When they were, first of all, Greece was lying about it, and then they weren't able to make the payments when the interest rates were going up.
But here's the problem. I mean, in the United States, we do that, don't we? I mean, we have a union. We have a Federal Reserve that covers the whole country. We have a national government. Europe has this sort of appearance of that, but not the reality. And therefore, people in Germany see themselves as sovereign, and they don't see that they have a stake. And their stake, by the way, is immense in keeping these other economies going. But they don't see it that way, and partly because the German leader, Ms. Merkel, has played it very, very safe there, going no step further than what her domestic consensus will allow, and not really laying it on the line to Germany and saying, listen, unless these economies recover, we won't. They won't buy our stuff. This is a round economic world here in Europe.
David, how do you think that image of austerity and its problems factors back into how people look at things here? I mean, is that what Paul Ryan is austerity? What Paul Ryan's asking for in this country? Is there fear about that, of it taking it down? Or is it the fear of the debt that makes it potent in the other direction?
Well, there is a call for austerity because of the debt that is behind the Ryan plan, and the Ryan plan, and I think you have to give Paul Ryan great credit for this, is one of the few that recognizes that you can't tackle the debt problem in the United States unless you tackle the Medicare problem in the United States. So it's somewhat remarkable to me that, having embraced Ryan, the Romney campaign is having a hard time embracing the Ryan plan. In fact, you heard Governor Romney say the other day that, you know, he was that in this campaign, that what made the difference was what was his plan and not necessarily all elements of the Ryan plan. Where are you seeing this show up? You're seeing it show up in polls in places like Florida, of all places, where you get an overwhelming number of people, no surprise, saying that whatever the solution to the debt is, it should not require a reduction in Medicare benefits.
Well,
that's what tackling Medicare ultimately is going to be all about.
But Laura Meckler, you've got liberal critics saying austerity takes us all down the drain.
Well, sure. I mean, liberal critics would say that we need more spending to stimulate the economy, and that then we'll create more jobs, and then we'll have more tax collections, and there that will take care of the deficit. You know, this is a fundamental debate over economic policy that exists in this country. I think, though, that, you know, you expressed some marvel at the fact that Romney sort of embraced Ryan but isn't embracing his plan. I in a way, am not particularly surprised by that. I mean, when you actually start looking at what the plan is, it does involve cuts to Medicare, and that is never politically popular. So the fact that he's backing off from that, I don't think is all that surprising, although, you know, I don't know that any politician, has ever been 100% intellectually consistent, and this would not necessarily be a nomination for that gallery, but it is in fact it's a very easy thing to attack. And of course, President Obama hasn't really said how he would deal with the Medicare problem himself. I mean, he talks about controlling the underlying cost of care, which is a really good idea and also really hard to do. And we really don't know if or how we can really attack that.
Let's go to Brian.
Laura makes a really excellent point here, which is it's not surprising that Governor Romney's backing away from the Ryan plan. But the question is, did the campaign have a plan for how they were going to deal with this as soon as they decided on Mr. Ryan as their nominee?
Right. Frankfort, Kentucky, if I may. Brian, you're on the air, Brian.
Yeah, Tom. Hello. How's it going?
Okay.
I'm calling because you asked about the jobs numbers and Romney being able to attack Obama.
Yeah.
There was something released yesterday, a revision from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that said from April of 2011 to March 2012, there was actually a net gain of 336,000 jobs.
Right, they revised the numbers on better data, and it's made President Obama a net job creator over what over that period. Granted, is it enough, though, Brian? I mean, look at where we are unemployment-wise.
We're actually above what we were in 2009 when he took job.
I mean, I'd like to jump in on this. I think that it's interesting because it is a symbolic thing. He can say that, yes, more jobs have been created than lost during the course of his term. From an economic point of view, it's almost meaningless. It's basically a rounding error. And it's just a small number of jobs given the vastness of the U.S. economy. But I think the underlying question, Tom, which you were getting at is, you know, how does it affect American perceptions of both the economy and of President Obama's stewardship of the economy? And my instinct is that people at this point pretty much have their impressions set of the economy. They know it's not great. There's in recent polls there show a greater optimism that it is getting better. That those numbers fuel into that narrative. Of course, the GDP numbers from the second quarter tend to work against that narrative. But you know, we have a couple more jobs reports to come out before the election, which will get much bigger headlines than that report did about the revision. And you know, we'll see if that makes a difference. But in September there was a pretty dreadful jobs report. It came out in 96,000 jobs were created in August. And that was right after the Democratic convention. And that was right as Obama's poll numbers were starting to take off. So the Obama campaign believes that people's perceptions of the economy are pretty well baked at this point. They don't necessarily think it's great. And yet a lot of people are still wanting to give him another 4 years. So obviously not everybody is. I think that sometimes it's easy to read too much into any one of these jobs reports economic reports.
Let's get a call from Chicago. Ken is calling. Ken in Chicago, you're on the air.
Yeah, just to go back to the Israeli issue, have they done polling from an electoral point of view on what the American support is, particularly in these battlegrounds, for supporting preemptive action against Iran? You know, after 10 years of war, does the body politic want to start a third one?
A fair question. David? Oh, Jack, have you got that?
Well, I was going to say, I don't have it in front of me, but the Chicago Foreign Policy Council came out with a massive study of American public opinion a week or so ago. And in there, as I remember, 70% was the figure, do not want a unilateral U.S. strike on Iran, and a majority did not want the United States to back up Israel should Israel make a strike. So that's some evidence.
That may be a break on that right now. Do you think that would be a break on that next year, David?
You know, I'm not certain it would be, because in the end, the Israelis are going to make a decision based on their own national interest. And then the question comes, if they get into this, does the United States then come in to back them up should the Iranians retaliate? And I've gone through over several years a number of different simulations of the set of events. I've heard about others, so I've seen, you know, both the unclassified ones I've been at. I've heard about some of the classified ones. They all come out the same way, Tom, which is sooner or later we get sucked in because the Iranians close the Strait of Hormuz to try to stop oil shipping and we go in to reopen it, or because some Iranian captain takes a pot shot in an American ship in the Persian Gulf, or because the Iranians go after a Saudi refining center. And so to some degree, once the Israelis start this, the chances the United States is going to be in the middle of whatever happens is pretty high.
Even though we've got these war games, show getting sucked in does not turn out well.
Getting sucked in does not turn out well. The war games are intended to make the point to the Iranians, don't even think about it. So what are they doing this month in the Persian Gulf? They're having a multi-nation exercise to show how quickly the Gulf could be cleared of mines if the Iranians mined it.
Lauren Meckler, we've got the debates starting next week. Mitt Romney, the President Obama, Barack Obama, first time face-to-face in that debate setting. What's the White House anticipating there?
Well, it's interesting. The White House is saying basically two things. One, they're saying that, you know, a debate is not really a boxing match. It's not something where you look for a knockout punch. It's really just another opportunity to get your message out. And I think that's why we saw, in addition to that 47% ad yesterday, we saw a two-minute direct-to-camera ad from President Obama where he was sort of laying out his case. And I think that that was meant as, in part, as kind of a prelude to the debate for him putting out his sort of specific economic plans. The other thing that the Obama campaign is spending a lot of time is doing is talking up the virtues of Mitt Romney. It's the only topic on which you'll hear senior Obama campaign officials consistently sing his praises about, you know, how good a debater he is, how well prepared he is, how bad a debater Barack Obama is. He hasn't done it in a long time. He's too long-winded. How the challenger usually wins. And it's all about setting expectations that if people go into this expecting Romney to do really well and it turns out to be sort of a draw, well, then that de facto is some sort of win for President Obama. So, you know, there's a lot of expectation setting going on ahead of this debate.
Jack, what do you think when these two are head-to-head next Wednesday night?
Well, Jim Fallows, in an excellent analysis in The Atlantic, points out that Mr. Romney really did well in the Republican debates, and he's had 50 hours of practice over the last year. On the other hand, he was running against a roster of candidates that Steve Schmidt, McCain's campaign manager, compared to the creatures in the bar scene in Star Wars. So we'll have to see how well he does against Mr. Obama.
David Sanger, were you jumping up and down about NFL refs this week at your house, or was that just the other 300 million people in the country, it seemed like?
Well, it was a lot of the other 300 million people, because while I'm not happy with the refs, I'm also a firm believer that no football should be played until the last inning of the World Series.
Okay, that's a short season indeed. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. Thank you so much for being with us today, David.
Thank you.
Laura Meckler, White House Correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Laura.
Good to be here.
And Jack Beatty, I understand you've got a big wedding up your way this weekend. Off goes your son. Many congratulations to
you. Thank you very much.
That is a blessed event. Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.